The Evolve Network is now live at evolvenetwork.tv. Subscribe for meal plans, recipes, cooking shows, and our very own The Magic Pill and The Magic Plant, as well as access to my favourite documentaries. The Evolve Network is also home to our full library of podcasts, with new release podcasts airing first and in full on the channel. You can also watch selected vodcasts in a video format. Meanwhile, enjoy this highlight of our podcast and head over to evolvenetwork.tv for the full Evolve podcast experience. The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, peteevans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. Brandon, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast and vodcast. How are you, brother?
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for having me, Pete.
This is a really fortunate meeting. We were introduced through our dear friend, Alex Svetsky, who has been an important part of the puzzle for me, actually, over the last 6 months to understand cryptocurrency, or more about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. And he suggested that you and I should have a conversation because you see Bitcoin as something that is reminiscent, or maybe not, or very similar to something that's very dear to my heart as well, being the mycelium network and fungus. So as soon as he said, Brandon talks about these two things, I was like, okay, I need to dive deep into this. So basically, I'd love to hand over this whole podcast to you to take us on this journey of how these things are similar. And really, for anybody that does not understand what a mycelium network is, maybe take us through step by step or the basics for the beginners. Thanks, brother.
Yeah, perfect. So a couple of things right at the top. One, I'm not a mycologist. I'm just a mushroom nerd for about a decade. I forage for them. I identify them. I cook them. I eat the active species, which we can talk about if it makes sense. And I just sort of nerd out on the ecology side. And then from a Bitcoin side, I'm like 4 or 5 years of pretty much full-time mental energy in that space. And once I found the overlap between these decentralized biological networks and how that relates to these decentralized monetary networks, everything started to click for me. I more or less rearranged my whole career, began selling my old online businesses and focusing all my attention in this space. So I'm very looking forward to this. I often say in the Bitcoin space that my secret mission is to turn on all the Bitcoiners and get them into mycology. And simultaneously, the mycology people, a lot of people have found Bitcoin from that more like biological analogy realm, which seems to be easier for a lot of people because most people aren't steeped in economics or money. And so they kind of sneak in the back door with biology, which is very, very appealing to me.
That's so cool because... sorry to interject here, but I love that because I was so steeped into the food and nutrition philosophy for the last decade. We made a film for called The Magic Pill, which ended up on Netflix. And it was interesting because the next film we made was on cannabis. And I was looking at all the people in the cannabis space going, you need to watch the film. that we just made on food. And the people in the food space, I was like, you need to watch this film that we're making in the cannabis space, because ketogenic paleo or whole food plus cannabis is part of the solution moving forward in the way that I see it. And not many people had linked the two together, you know, from both camps. I'm like, oh, this is the perfect synergy or the perfect symbiotic relationship. And I'm so loving what I understand about Bitcoin now, because it's another solution to self-sovereignty. Sorry to throw that in there, but I'm just fascinated by these links that are starting to happen in these spaces. So over to you again, mate.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like we're going to be a lot of rabbit hole tangents on this one, because you mentioned the sovereignty part, which is near and dear to my heart, also very much so with Alex. And how I would say that is it's almost like you can't have true self-sovereignty today if you don't have a monetary network that's out of the control of the state. And so I view Bitcoin as almost a prerequisite for any type of homesteading, hippie commune, any type of like independence or sovereignty that you have. The monetary network is just this foundational thing. And so Bitcoin does represent like kind of the base layer of the sovereignty stack, if you will. You mentioned another nice point there regarding how like multiple topics kind of converge. And that's really interesting to you. And that's how I am. I'm a master generalist all over the place. But what I look for in that pursuit, which you could consider yourself a polymath, or on the bad side, you could be a dilettante, right? Just aimlessly wandering and, you know, kind of just not achieving anything. However, what I look for in this like broad search, what I'm spending my time on ultimately, is for consilience. Which is a term made up by a biologist, which essentially means that when you have a bunch of separate viewpoints overlapping on the same truth, you can have a higher degree of certainty that it's true, right? So if we look at Bitcoin from a monetary layer, okay, cool, there's monetary properties, I see how it works. Then you overlay, okay, Bitcoin actually represents an evolutionary strategy found in mycelium. Okay, if that's true, now we have two things stacking. And the more angles we come to this, the more true it feels, without getting into the tricky waters of defining truth. Okay, should we go into Fungi 101?
Let's do it.
Okay. So for the uninitiated, fungi are their own kingdom, right? There's animals, there's plants, there's all these different kingdoms, and fungi have their own. They're not a plant. They're actually more similar to humans than they are to plants. So way back in the taxonomic history, humans broke off from fungi. Fungi decided they were going to have external stomachs. Humans decided they were going to have internal stomachs. That's essentially the branch. We both inhale oxygen. We both exhale carbon dioxide. There's more fungi species than all plants and animals combined. And there's a tremendous diversity in the kingdom. So just step one, appreciate our fungi. Next, let's talk about ecology a little bit. Like, what is the point of a fungi? Right? They serve a couple of main roles. One, they are the grand molecular disassemblers, or the recyclers on our planet. So they actually use chemistry to break down complex structures. Think a tree branch lands in the forest. What happens to the tree branch? Well, the fungi leap out of the ground and they start digesting it externally with chemistry. And then some bacteria also participate, and they break those things down into their base elements. So they're recycling. And they also connect underground to all the trees, and they form essentially a biological internet. And what this does is it allows trees underground to trade resources and trade information. And so there's this entire underground economy going around. And I spoke with an evolutionary biologist recently, recorded a podcast. And what she's studying is the nitty-gritty economic behaviors. And what she's finding is that some trees, they buy high and they sell low, right? They create trade tariffs. And when it rains, they hoard all the water when water is abundant. And then when the drought comes, the fungi sell that water at a higher price.
Fuck off. And so, no way.
True story. Look up Toby Kears if you want to hear her research. She's amazing, and her research is mind-blowing. And so what does this tell us? Number one, I don't know exactly, but back to consilience, it's another stack. Okay, maybe economics is just a fundamental organizing principle of biology, right? In a sense that biological organisms have to make decisions. Where do they go? What do they eat? What when to reproduce, right? All those calculations come into play, and they're managing resources. right? Underground is a very, very competitive environment. And so they have to make good strategic decisions. And if you multiply that over the long history of biological time, evolutionary time, these are adaptive processes. The fungi learn how to master their environment, and that involves trade and economics. And so that's kind of how they fit into our ecosystem. And now the difference between a mushroom and mycelium, this one gets caught up a lot. Most people think the mushroom is the organism, right? You see the little thing you buy in the grocery store, you go for a walk in the woods and you see this funny thing. However, that is simply the reproductive organ of that species, right? So it's like the apple on a tree, where the tree or the main fungal body is actually underground. And we call that form the mycelial form. And what it is a one cell walled network. You can think of it like a microscopic root system. It's a series of tubes with pumps and elevators, and they just send resources bidirectionally through this tube. So you can think of it like a living membrane underground, and it's constantly in communication with its surroundings. And when the conditions are perfect for that mycelial mat underground, what it does is it concentrates its energy underneath the surface of the ground, and then it sends up a mushroom. And that mushroom, as soon as it reaches maturity, it releases little spores, little mushroom seeds, and those spores hit the ground nearby. And if the conditions are right, they colonize new territory and off they go, they're reproducing. Right. So that's probably the basics we can get into there. There's so many more interesting things, but we could spend all night on that. Okay. Fungi 101, any pause there before we tie it to Bitcoin?
Not at all, but I do want to get into psychedelics a little bit down the track as well and understand how that part plays a part in this and whether there's any economic value in a psychedelic, why they appear. But let's go down that path a little later on.
Yeah, bookmark that. I'm interested in that topic. So, okay, let's tie this to Bitcoin. The thing with mycelium that's very interesting is that there's no central point of control. There's no brain. There's no processor. What happens is it's more like a network of individual branches, end tips, these little root tips. And each one of those are making decisions based on what they think makes sense in their local area. And so it's really like a network of millions of cells that are all part of the same organism making decisions. And that's so much different and hard to understand for humans who think very highly of ourselves and our nice big brains and our, you know, it's the same like computers. They have the central processing unit. Mushrooms, mycelium, they're not like this. And now Bitcoin. Bitcoin is not a company. There's no organization. There's no leader. There's no CEO. There's no marketing team. Instead, it's an open source software protocol that runs on millions of computers all around the world. And people voluntarily participate in this monetary network. And as individuals, together, we create the network, right? And if I have a different opinion from you, we can do different things in the network and no one can tell us otherwise. And so it's a very interesting emergent monetary system, right? 12 years ago, it was launched at a value of zero. Now, about 12 years in, it's worth over $1 trillion. Again, no one's in charge. But what it does is it attracts adherence because it's the incentives of Bitcoin lead people to find it has value and they keep it alive, et cetera. And to take this further, the protocol itself actually pays people to keep it going. Right, that's through the mining process. It issues new Bitcoin tokens every 10 minutes to the people that do the accounting and do the security for Bitcoin. Right, so it's paying us to keep it alive, and in return, by owning the asset, so far it's gone up a lot. So the people who've bought Bitcoin actually are wealthier. So we have this incentive to keep it going, to recruit new people, to protect it, and so it's kind of this weird cybernetic meta-organism made up of humans and software all around the world. And so from that angle, it starts to appear that it's alive, right? When people attack the network, what happens? Well, information travels through the Bitcoin community. The developers learn about it. They create new software. They patch the network. They send it out and all the nodes update the software. And now the Bitcoin software became stronger, right? It learned from environmental stimulus. This is the same with mycelium. That mycelial mat underground, it bumps into a predator. What happens? Okay, it sends information back to the mushroom scientists. They create a custom enzyme. They're the best chemists on the planet. They create a new enzyme, never before seen, to address the predator. Then they ship it around the whole network. And now that single mycelial mat has a new tool to defend itself. And some of these mycelial mats are thousands of years old, and they've been dealing with predators this whole time. And so again, they build up this library of defenses, just like how Bitcoin learns and gets stronger from people attacking it. And Taleb would call this anti-fragile, right? It gains from disorder. The more you attack it, the stronger it gets. And that's a unique system. Our computer internet is also similar. And when you look at this from an archetypal standpoint, what you see is that this decentralized intelligence network, it actually keeps popping up. Okay, we've seen it in mycelium. We actually have the same type of network in our brain. That's how our neurons work. If you zoom way out and you look at how all mass is in the solar system, again, it forms this decentralized network. And so zooming into our neurons, zooming out to the entire surface of the entire galaxy, and then also in our own biology, you keep seeing the same evolutionary strategy. And to me, what that says is if it's a strategy that works for billions of years in fungi and trillions of years in the universe, that's a pretty good evolutionary strategy, right? Nature doesn't come up with strategies that don't work. And so to me, that lends a little more confidence to Bitcoin, again, as this decentralized intelligence network that just so happens to be money. Better stop there. Take a breather.
I don't want to get caught up in it, but you brought up something that I haven't discussed with Alex before, and that's the attacking of Bitcoin. What does that mean? And how take us through that in how we can understand what that made. Give us an example, and why does it get attacked?
Yeah, that's a really important question for a couple of reasons. One, it's not that intuitive to understand the different ways to attack Bitcoin and actually understanding how resilient it is. But a new person to the space, very rightly so, would say, okay, I get Bitcoin, seems cool, but you're directly competing with government money. So wouldn't the government, if Bitcoin got big enough, wouldn't the government just shut it down? Right? It's a pretty rational question. However, the answer is a lot more tricky. So number one, there's been decades of people trying to create private money on the internet. That's what PayPal was originally trying to do. You've got things like eGold, Liberty Reserve, B-Money, Hashcash. There's a long history of people trying to do this. And what they found is that all of those previous attempts failed. And why did they fail? Because they were centralized, meaning there was a central point of failure that the government could come in, you know, knock down the door, men with guns, hey, turn it off. And they did. So what Satoshi did, the pseudonymous person or group who created Bitcoin, the whole design was for survivability. We need to make this thing unstoppable. And so how they did that was they decentralized the ledger. So millions of people around the world have a copy of the ledger, meaning you couldn't shut down Bitcoin in North America. The Bitcoin network would keep going, just the people in North America would suffer, right? And so it can route around any attack like that. And there's many other things we can go into that get a little hairy. But the reason why it's hard to attack is because technically speaking, a single government or even a group of governments, they couldn't really stop it head on. It's just this slippery thing that's everywhere and nowhere, and you just can't attack it head on. However, governments, what they can do is attack the social layer. And I think that's the more likely outcome. And what that means is that you'll attack the area where the Bitcoin network connects to your bank. So this could be an exchange or an application or something like that. And that's not ideal, right? They guard the entrance of the exchanges. And what they're doing right now is they're saying, we need your personal information. And they're sort of like creeping in on your privacy with your money. And I expect that to continue. We'll probably lose some privacy in the process. I also expect some nation states to try to ban it. For example, India has tried to ban it. China has banned it and then unbanned it like three times. And these are powerful nations, right? Especially China. And what they find is that they can't really ban it because Bitcoin ultimately is information. And information is extremely hard to police. I mean, they can't even stop cannabis in the United States. It's everywhere. And it's been illegal for how long? They couldn't stop alcohol during Prohibition. What makes them think that they can stop invisible information? Right. I can memorize the password to my Bitcoin in my head and cross a border with all my Bitcoin intact. And so it's really not possible to stop. And I would actually reframe the question. If there's any, I'm sure there's lots of world leaders and heads of state listening to this podcast. And my advice to them would be to embrace Bitcoin because you can't stop it. So you might as well embrace it. It's just like the internet. right? In the 90s in the US, our politicians, they said, what do we do with this thing? Bad people are using it. There's potential for bad things to occur. However, what Congress said at the time was they came to the conclusion that we should do no harm, and instead we should embrace innovation. And the outcome of that was the United States benefited tremendously because the majority of the commercial internet, think Apple, Facebook, Netflix, Google, et cetera, that's all made in the United States. So that both gave power to the US and a lot of wealth. And so a smart nation would see that that happened in the 90s, the same thing's happening here, and it's time to embrace this thing.
I like it. I posted something about Bitcoin yesterday onto my Telegram site, and I've mentioned this with Alex before, we've discussed it, but I'd like to get your take on it too. There are more opinions about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency than I've seen in the dietary space, that I've seen in the political space, that I've seen in any space, the vaccine, fucking pharmaceutical space. They're very emotive, these people. And they started attacking one of the people that follows me on Telegram. Like, it was like this gang of individuals started attacking one person that was sort of saying, why don't you listen to the podcast that Pete and Alex have done? And they were like, you're a paid shrill, you're this, you're that, you're a fucking... I was like, whoa, there's some anger out there about this. And nobody's trying to sell anything, which is the strangest part of this. Like, there was no advertising for Alex's app. There was no mention of, I've never said to anybody, you may want to buy into Bitcoin, but I'm sharing information, but it's really triggering. And some of the feedback I got was the Three Gorges Dam, when that goes, Bitcoin's over. When the deep state want to turn off Bitcoin, they created it. It was CIA, because it was a pseudonym person that created it. People don't trust in this whatsoever. Like, it really brings up these, you mentioned archetypes before, but it brings up so much powerlessness, anger, rage, victim mentality, distrust, the list goes on. And I'm wondering what this is about. And is it just we have a victim mentality around currency and our own self-worth? And that's a pretty big statement that I'm making there, but it is a question.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it's really important right now, because what you find in Bitcoin is there are these four-year cycles. And so far, at least in the last 12 years, every 4 years, there's 1 year where there's a big, massive price run. And then the following year, a price decline, 2 more years of flat, and another price run. And when Bitcoin's price is growing extremely fast, a whole bunch of new people enter the space. And so you have all these people who bump into this thing, and new people without too much research start sharing their opinions. Usually those opinions are not very well researched. And so there's kind of like a butting of heads with the Bitcoin people and the non-Bitcoin people. And so I guess the question is, like, why does it get so heated? Why is Bitcoin so heated? And there's a couple of things I think here. One, the first time you hear about Bitcoin, it's pretty rational to dismiss it or to assume it can't work. Not to mention, it kind of sounds like a scam. Right. Some magic guy created magic internet money, and it keeps going up in price and no one can stop it. And, you know, that alone sort of sets a trigger off. Most humans have like a bullshit detector, and Bitcoin sets off all the alarms the first time you hear it. Same for me. Almost everyone had this problem. And so, OK, you got to go a little deeper. Second, Bitcoin and money in general, let's not even say Bitcoin, money itself is somewhat religious. If you look throughout ancient texts, there's a lot of connotations between money and the church. Oftentimes, the church actually was the dominant institution in society. And so money was run through them. And so we have this like deep connotation there. And to get metaphysical for a second, money is essentially tokenized time or tokenized work. right? You did something for society. You created value in society. In exchange, society gave you this token to prove the amount of work or value you created. Now you hold this token of time and work money. And in the future, you can spend that work and time on, you can buy someone else's work and time, right, with the money. And so it's very, very deep into humanity. Next, Bitcoin is actually a political ideology, not just money, right? So buying Bitcoin is essentially saying that I support the individual sovereignty, and I believe the individual has the right to own their own money, right? It's essentially saying that I do not want the government to tell me what I can and cannot do with the fruits of my own labor. And, you know, if Bitcoin continues, essentially the result is money will be no longer an artifact of the state, and instead it will be an artifact of the people. So just like we separated religion from state, we just decided it's better for the state not to do that. We're going to do the same thing with money. Money should be a free market good that anyone around the world can choose to participate in. Now, why would you want to do that? Okay, if you're in a developed nation and you have a relatively sound banking system without capital controls, you might say the state money's fine. What's the big deal? Okay, understandable. However, if you live in under a dictatorship, maybe you live in Venezuela, Zimbabwe, Argentina, Cyprus, Greece, Turkey, all these countries that are having massive currency failures regularly. What happens to those people? Right. If you're just an average person, you're experiencing your hard-earned savings in your bank account just crashing, and you have no wealth. Your entire savings is destroyed because your country, your government broke the currency. And what Bitcoin does is it allows anyone in the world to participate in a monetary system that is not forced upon them by their jurisdiction, by their government. And so that's a very empowering thing. It's a very political thing. And so that will fire people up. Now, the last one you mentioned, like, do we have issues with money, right? Are we sort of like having this lack mentality, or that we don't deserve money, or what's sort of like the trauma around it? I think that's also very important, right? It's tied to our self-worth. As a man, we're supposed to provide. There's a whole bunch of stuff tangled up there. Simultaneously, if we zoom way out on a macroeconomic scale, right now we're at the end of a long-term credit cycle. Inequality is at its all-time high. You know, the stock market's at all times high. Well, people are losing all their jobs, especially during this pandemic nonsense and the lockdowns. And so people are pissed, and they believe that the financial system is not working for them. And so they're a little bit more sensitive to the fact that this Bitcoin thing, what's it going to do, right? We're all heightened over our money. And so I don't know how to get around this stuff exactly, other than teaching people what money actually is. And I think the tricky thing there is people assume they understand money. I've had it my whole life. I have a bank account, yada, yada. But actually, money is a very, very tricky thing to understand. And even after spending thousands of hours thinking about the topic, I learned something new about it all the time. And so what I would encourage people who are sort of like allergic to Bitcoin is take a look at that, right? If you're triggered by something, there's usually a good reason, and it's usually a reason you're not going to like. So shine a light on your demon there and figure out why you're triggered by it. And it probably has to do with your own misunderstanding about money, potentially your own self-worth, potentially like casting the blame on wealthy people because they're the problem, that they're the reason you don't have money, or something like that. But examine that from first principles. You might be surprised.
Very well said, mate. You mentioned something before, like how Bitcoin rewards the people that support it. So the miners, the people that keep the nodes operating, so that it's going back to the mycelium network, you know, no one's in control, so to speak. And there's a limited supply of Bitcoin, with it, I think it's 21 million. What happens when you reach that peak? Because in a mycelium network, obviously, is there a peak that can be reached, a ceiling that can be reached? So talk to me about this ceiling and understand, because some people think that once 21 million have finished being mined, whichever date that is in the coming decades, then Bitcoin's finished. So explain that concept to us in relation to the mycelium network as well.
Yeah, good point. So the first thing is here, I want to define the difference between wealth and monetary units or currency or something like that. And it will make sense in a second here. So right now, the US government and many other governments are printing tremendous amounts of new currency, new dollar units. In the US alone, in the last 12 months, we printed like 25% of the total supply of dollars outstanding were created in the last 12 months. So a money that's been around for over 100 years, 25% of the units were created in the last 12 months. That's insane. And now the question is, okay, we have more money out there, but did we create 25% more wealth? Is there 25% more goods and intellectual capital and businesses and supply chains and products and services? No, we just inflated the monetary supply, but the actual wealth is a fixed amount. Right, we can create more by creating businesses and satisfying customers, but simply creating units doesn't create more wealth. And if we bring that to biology, what's happening underground? Those organisms.
I really hope you enjoyed the first half of this podcast. If you'd like to listen to the rest, please visit evolvenetwork.tv. That's evolvenetwork.tv. We'll see you there.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.